This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Homeland Security and Corruption in Congress. Hello again, I'm Orman Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The state of Wyoming and North Pole, Alaska get more per capita than New York, Los Angeles, or Chicago to prepare for terrorism. Now, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff says the dollars should go where the risk is greatest. On To The Point, what is the state of Homeland Security more than 4 years after September 11th? On Reporter's Notebook later on, as Jack Abramoff pleads guilty to new charges, how serious is Washington's latest political scandal? What's the difference between Abramoff's activities and business as usual on Capitol Hill? First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. When it comes to preparing for terrorism, the Department of Homeland Security wants to focus on risk now instead of politics. On To The Point, does that mean America's going to be safer? On Reporter's Notebook, Jack Abramoff's guilty pleas have rocked Capitol Hill. What's the difference between a bribe and a contribution? First, this news update. For 3 hours last night, family members thought 12 of the 13 men trapped in a West Virginia coal mine had been rescued alive. Then came the stunning and tragic news that only one had survived. In the meantime, some 400 newspapers covered the wrong story worldwide. Cable television carried interviews with relatives who said that a miracle had occurred. Greg Mitchell is editor of Editor and Publisher, which is a journal covering the media and particularly the newspaper industry. Greg Mitchell, thanks for joining us.
Hi, hey, thanks. Glad to be here again.
You have said today that this is one of the most disturbing and disgraceful media performances of its kind in recent years. That's a harsh verdict very soon after the facts in question. Why did you reach it?
Well, I, like many other people, I went to bed with this miracle in my head and woke up to a different reality this morning and started checking first thing how newspapers had covered it, which is our primary focus, and found one newspaper after another had carried headlines and stories that reported the miracle rescue as fact without with very few, if any, qualifiers or revealing that this had not been confirmed, were only reports and so forth. So it seemed to me that while there is plenty of blame to go around, and we have not yet heard the true chain of events, and that people are going to be pointing fingers at each other, at the minimum, the press needs to nail down stories before, especially when lives are at stake and so forth, before declaring flatly that something has happened when it's mainly reports and rumors and unconfirmed statements by maybe one official.
You say in your piece today that some editors have blamed officials, including the governor, for misleading them. What qualifiers should they have used that they failed to use?
Well, a good one is a very short word called unconfirmed. We see this often when reporters and editors feel like using it. They just say unconfirmed reports, or they put in a headline or in the first line of a story reportedly or according to qualified reports or according to some sources and so forth. So it's actually a very easy thing to do. I mean, and sometimes papers can get away with headlines that seem more declarative. It can be embarrassing, but they'll say, well, those are headlines. You know, headlines have to do that. But the stories are qualified. In this case, that did happen sometimes, but very often that was reported as fact when it should have been more qualified.
Again, we're talking with Greg Mitchell, who's editor of Editor and Publisher. Well, why do you think it occurred the way it did, given that you mentioned some of the major papers in the country failed to use the kind of qualifiers that you think they should have?
Right. Well, of course, part of it is many papers, when you get the smaller papers, particularly just run AP copy, and AP was reporting it as fact. The other thing is that will be interesting to be looked at And I think this is an interesting story, because I think things will emerge to the rest of today and in the days ahead on how this actually happened. I think there's going to be a lot of gray area. But one interesting to look at is how much TV drove this and how much the media in general contributed to the spreading of the false reports, where it's the genesis seems to have been, you know, someone running into the church and announcing it, someone overhearing a cell phone call, people celebrating, the governor who was there then got caught up in it, and people either semi-confirmed it, or people thought he was confirming it, or he said something because he assumed it was correct because people were celebrating. So it may have been a case where the officials thought it was true because the media was reporting it, and the media thought it was true because the governor was not disputing it. And the coal company officials apparently knew the truth fairly quickly and didn't want to say anything until they were sure. So it was a horrendous situation, but it'll be interesting as the smoke clears to find out how much the media was a victim and how much it helped push the story along.
What is the responsibility, do you think, of the media now, with coal now being said to take such an important role in providing energy for the United States, obviously a very dangerous profession? Do you think we'll see a lot of investigative stories about that, a lot of coverage of how dangerous it really is and to what extent we really want to rely on it?
Right. Well, you know, unfortunately, these kind of disasters spark media probes that maybe were not planned, and I think people will look into this. Certainly this company will get a lot of scrutiny, and the whole situation of coal mines that are in bad shape, and some of them go bankrupt, and another company takes them over. And I from what I understand, the company involved here is saying that, yes, there were problems there, but they just bought the place, and they were making improvements, and they shouldn't be blamed for past problems. So it's a real mess, but I think it's good that the coal industry gets this kind of scrutiny.
All right. Well, thanks as always, Greg Mitchell, for being with us.
Thank you.
Editor of Editor and Publisher. In a moment, a change in strategy at the Department of Homeland Security on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Columbus, Ohio used Homeland Security money on body armor for firehouse dogs. Newark, New Jersey air-conditioned its garbage trucks. North Pole, Alaska got $500,000 to protect just 1,700 people. Now the Homeland Security Secretary, Michael Chertoff, says funds to fight terrorism are not, as he calls them, party favors to be distributed as widely as possible. He says tough choices will have to be made based on the real risk of attack by terrorists. Walter Pinkett covers national security for The Washington Post. Walter, good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be here.
How much of a difference is this going to make in the way the money is given out?
Well, I think you have to wait and see. This is not all the money. It's $765 million, but Homeland Security has a couple billion. And this is just one of the programs. It's a counterterrorism program, and there's still money that's going to be divided up by state, same way public works are done, by population. So it's if you look at Homeland Security as having a set of bank accounts, this is one of them and one of the bigger ones, but it's not the only one.
I think, did you misspeak? You said it would be divided by state according to population. The complaint
is not
according to population.
No. This particular package, the $765 million, is now going to be going to cities that are at risk. But there's still hundreds of millions of dollars that is going to still be divided up by state. So this is, as I was saying, there are a couple bank accounts, if you think of it that way, that Homeland Security has to pass out, and this is one of them.
You mentioned $765 million. That is a reduction, as I understand it, from the last year, which was $855 million. How is the reduction justified?
Well, I think they're cutting back, at least in Homeland Security. The other part about the programs are these are not sort of annual grants. In other words, you put in for the money, it helps you meet what you think are the problems you face. But once you get that money, you're buying things. You're not paying for people that come up every year. So it's not a permanent subsidy, although some people are treating it that way, and that's one of the problems.
What are some of the other problems with the Department of Homeland Security that have been illuminated both by the 9/11 Commission and by its own Inspector General?
Well, I think, first of all, the one you hit on in your opening, and that is the money is going for odd projects. The second part is that the Homeland Security Agency was put together in a rather haphazard way, and it really has never been integrated because it's a series of over 20 different agencies that had different jobs. And in the sort of heat of 9/11, Congress, particularly Senator Lieberman, put together a proposal which the administration opposed for a while. Then when it became popular, it supported it. And it never really had the hearings and the sort of analysis you need to put together a department as big as this with as many diverse groups.
One of the things that you have pointed to is the fact that together in the Department of Homeland Security are agencies that deal with terrorism as well as natural disasters, as we saw with Hurricane Katrina. How does that, do you think, cause problems for the new department?
Well, this has always been an issue. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is the one that everybody focuses on because when Katrina came along, it wasn't a terrorist disaster, it was a natural disaster. And most of the work that FEMA has been doing since the reorganization has focused around terrorism. And it led its, what really is its main and always has been its main function, dealing with natural disasters, become a kind of second level. And so when a natural disaster occurred, the people and particularly the leadership weren't prepared for it.
Well, even now, as I understand it, when money is given out, it can be used. This is the money we were talking about earlier with the Urban Area Security Initiative, $765 million. It can be used for things that aren't necessarily or don't seem to be immediately related to terrorism, but they have to have dual use. They have to also be applicable to terrorism. Is that appropriate?
Well, I think that's a difficult one to figure out. In other words, Secretary Chertoff made that statement, but he also, in a background that took place afterwards, one of his undersecretaries made it clear that at least with this fund, the $765 million, terrorism has to be the primary aim. And if there is a dual use, fire trucks or preparing for fire truck issues, that will be considered. But they have five main characteristics they're looking for, and those five, which are going to determine who gets the money and for what, are really associated with terrorism.
And so that is the main thrust, even though, as you point out, FEMA has the primary responsibility of responding to natural disasters, things that don't necessarily involve terrorism. Certainly, though, some of the same things are required, a health service, for example, and first responders that know what they're doing and all that sort of thing.
Oh, no, that's all very true, and you really have to wait and see how these programs work. I mean, they're doing all sorts of studies. Proposals you put forward for this particular money are going to be based on the risks that you face as in these sort of 35 metropolitan areas. And you're going to have to meet new criteria, which means there's new bureaucracy measuring sort of where each dollar goes.
Does it appear the next allocation of money, as I understand it, will be in June to the 35 metropolitan areas as opposed to the 50 cities or so that were involved before in this particular program, Urban Area Security Initiative? Do you think that the chances are good that we'll be safer as a result?
Well, the safeness really depends more on what the threat is and whether everybody's armed with new fire trucks and new intelligence.
As well as, you're saying intelligence as well as equipment.
As well as equipment.
Is there any way to judge that at this point?
Well, there is a whole school, and I cover intelligence in general. There is a school that's emerging that you don't hear much about that thinks the terrorist threat has been overstated, that in fact 9/11 did the opposite of what it was supposed to do. And Osama bin Laden's view is supposed to remove us from the Middle East. Instead of doing that, it has brought us in the Middle East with both feet. And one reason there hasn't been an attack since is that it was counterproductive in the first place.
Final question to you. We're talking about Homeland Security here, but it's my understanding that just to protect military bases in the United States, the Department of Defense has a budget much larger than the Department of Homeland Security. Is that right?
Oh, it's not only a much larger budget. In terms of this, I've been writing about the increase of domestic intelligence on the part of the military, which has been handed to some degree that responsibility, set up a new command called Northern Command. And one of the illustrations I used is that Northern Command has, off the bat, started in January, 296 intelligence analysts. The State Department's intelligence section has less than 200, and Homeland Security, I'm told, has less than 80. So the military outstrips everybody. They have more money than anybody, and their budgets for intelligence, domestic intelligence, are secret.
Walter Pincus, again, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Richard Falkenrath is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also a former deputy Homeland Security advisor and deputy assistant to the president. Had that job from 2003 to 2004. He was senior director for policy and special assistant to the president in the Office of Homeland Security before that. Richard Falkenrath, welcome to our program.
Happy to be here.
Let's pick up on this last point by Walter Pincus. Are we, do you think, responding in the wrong way to the wrong threat?
Well, no, I don't. There are a lot of threats out there, but there's no question that if you look at the sort of attacks that could cause massive casualties on the U.S. homeland, they are predominantly terrorist attacks. And getting ready to deal with those threats, those contingencies, it's got to be a very high priority for the federal government. And the federal government spends a lot of time and money working on that, in the first instance trying to prevent attacks before they occur, but secondly trying to protect targets and get ready to respond if they can. There have been some progress. There's a lot more work to be done, but I think it's an appropriate thing for the federal government to be working on.
What about what Walter Pincus says some of his sources have told him, that the terrorists have decided that 9/11 was counterproductive, didn't get the U.S. out of the Middle East, made it more involved than ever. Consequently, there's less of a threat here than there was before.
I don't doubt there are some sources who think that and are telling it to reporters like Mr. Pincus, but I don't think it's the consensus view of the intelligence community. I certainly don't believe it.
What about the behavior so far and the structural issues at the Department of Homeland Security? How do you think they're doing?
Well, it's a constant struggle. It's one of the toughest jobs in government to lead that department. I think Mr. Pincus has overstated it a little bit. There are not 22 different agencies. There's six main operating agencies in the Department of Homeland Security, two border agencies, TSA, which does airport security, Secret Service, FEMA, and the Coast Guard. And that's the preponderance of DHS. There's a small grant-making office and a small science and technology office, but really it's the six main agencies I just mentioned. So he has to manage that, and he has to take care of, he being the Secretary of Homeland Security, some of the absolute toughest issues in American governance today: border security, immigration, airport security, emergency response and recovery. These are really, really hard issues. And so, yeah, they're struggling. They're making some progress. I think directionally they have it right, but they're not to the point where anybody is satisfied yet.
What about this issue of mixing the kinds of priorities you talked about with natural disaster and the problems we saw with FEMA? Mr. Pincus says he thinks that it may have been pushed to a sort of second level in the department because its main priority is dealing with terrorism.
Well, I think he's wrong about that. The FEMA, since 9/11, has had to deal with many natural disasters. They failed miserably in Katrina. There's no question about that. But prior to Katrina, they dealt with a lot of natural disasters and basically handled them fine. And it remained the highest priority for FEMA day in and day out when it was an independent agency and when it was a department. Structurally, for the U.S. government, I think it's essential that we not have stovepiped response capabilities. that we not have one response mechanism for something, for bad weather, and another response mechanism for a bad attack. You need to basically have them integrated, because operationally what they need to do in the event of a natural disaster or a terrorist attack are very similar. And that is the direction the department is going on. They've obviously still got a lot of work to do, but it is the right direction.
Let me go back to Walter Pincus, again, national security reporter of the Washington Post. One of the arguments for the Department of Homeland Security was to eliminate duplication. What about what we just heard about stovepiping and separating agencies that really have very similar requirements and need similar facilities in order to carry them out?
Well, stovepiping is bad in certain terms, but in certain areas, but sometimes it's good. In the intelligence field, which has taken most of the criticism, stovepiping in certain areas gets you contrary views, whereas consensus eliminates views that maybe you want to hear. So it's got a mixed sort of record. Going back to FEMA, though, I think if you go to the history of FEMA, we went through the same kind of situation during the Cold War, when it was decided that FEMA would be the main sort of response to a nuclear attack, and a good portion of what it did was to stock supplies all over the country in case of a massive nuclear attack. And what happened, what worked out and what is going on again today, when you put national security into something, a whole section of the agency is cleared for classified material and the rest of them aren't. And there was a huge division within FEMA that had to be corrected primarily during the Clinton administration, when Jamie Lee Witt turned it around, got it out of mostly the ex-Cold War business and turned it into a natural disaster administration, which did excellent work. I take issue to some degree. If you go back to the hurricanes that hit Florida late last year, early this year, FEMA did not do a good job. And in fact, they still have people living in trailers. I mean, that's one of their jobs, to sort of run things after a disaster is over. And if you have them continually preparing for something that hasn't happened, you really have mixed signals.
Walter Pincus at the Washington Post, Richard Falkenrath at Brookings. Just a minute left before we go to a break. We'll come back after that. But what about this point that perhaps the requirements of these different agencies aren't as similar as they seem?
Well, I think when you actually get inside of the operations, what needs to happen in the event of, say, a nuclear weapons detonation in the United States or a massive earthquake, they tend to be very similar, what you need the federal government to do, the sort of logistics, the command and control apparatus, the communications. And my point is that it makes no sense whatsoever to have one mechanism for natural disasters and another mechanism for man-made disasters or deliberate attacks. And the direction of the department is to integrate those and to build on FEMA's natural disaster response capabilities into something which is a genuine, all-purpose, all-hazards response capability. That's what the department needs to do. They're not there yet. Everyone agrees on that, but that's the direction they need to head.
Richard Falkenrath at Brookings, formerly with the Bush administration, Walter Pincus with the Washington Post. We'll be back with them. Also, Stephen Flynn, also author of America the Vulnerable, How Our Government is Failing to Protect Us from Terrorism. On Reporter's Notebook, a long look at the Abramoff scandal. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking today about the Department of Homeland Security, its priorities being changed somewhat, according to the Secretary, Michael Chertoff, to emphasize risk as opposed to other considerations in the giving out of federal money with regard to homeland security and particularly protection against terrorism. As advertised, Stephen Flynn is with us. He's senior fellow for the National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book I mentioned, America the Vulnerable, How Our Government is Failing to Protect Us from Terrorism. Mr. Flynn, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What do you say to, or let me ask you to defend your title, I suppose. So first of all, in the context that we've been speaking, particularly with Richard Falkenrath, path formally with the Bush administration. Why do you think our government is failing to protect us?
Well, I think the basic issue of have we making our society less vulnerable to terrorist attacks has largely been an undone task for most of the 4 years since the 9/11 attacks, that virtually all the effort has gone into the best defense is a good offense. You need to take the battle to the enemy. It's a battle that, of course, requires an incredible amount of very good intelligence to be able to be successful at, none of which we have. Or we have just very limited amounts, let's say, as we've found time and again. Even Iraq, we're having a heck of a time, obviously, stopping terrorist attacks, and we've got a pretty good footprint down there. What we haven't done is dealt with the core realities of what happened on 9/11, that the terrorists were here. They didn't import a weapon of mass destruction. They converted a domestic airliner into one. And that many of the real costly consequences were things that we did to ourselves because we essentially were spooked, that we overreacted in some elements here because national traumas are not times when democracies work best. And so the case that I've been generally trying to make is the need for greater resilience. And so, you know, the start of the program, of course, you talked about the reprioritization of what really is a very, very pretty small sum of money. I mean, we're talking, you know, this total budget here of $765 million going out to our large and urban areas. Well, putting that into context, we're going to spend over $440 billion on our Department of Defense this year. And we've got to spread this money out over 35 urban cities, and we're going to now do it around a risk-based formula. Well, that's progress, but is the world turned upside down? If you're going to do any effective business plan, what you do is you'd look around your society and say, what are our greatest vulnerabilities? And if you believe the threat is real, and I do, and that the terrorists have some capabilities, which they've demonstrated, you say, what are the areas where, if they hit, would lead to either the massive loss of life or create real disruption to our lives? And then what do we need to safeguard them, and how much will it cost?
Well, isn't that what the Secretary now says he wants to do, at least in terms of the distribution of the $765 million?
Well, no. I mean, yes, at a micro level he's doing that. $1.2 billion? Where did we come up with the dollars that we're going to give to safeguard our cities or safeguard the rest of the societies? You know, the overall $2 billion in grants. You know, where did that number come from? And it came from, well, I guess that sounds good. Let's distribute it according to this new formula, which the Secretary will try to do in a much more reasonable way than has been done to date. The broader issue, again, we should be inventorying, as we've attempted to do, not successfully, what is critical in society, and then who should pay the cost and how much will it cost? And really at the heart of this has been an issue that we haven't debated, which is the role of the federal government in homeland security. Essentially what we came out saying, this responsibility rests primarily on the shoulders of states and localities and on the private sector to take care of. The federal government's job is national defense, the traditional stuff, the things we're doing overseas in Iraq and so forth, and border control. And everything else is left to states and locals and the private sector. Well, I think we should have a debate about that because it's clear that not much in the way investment is being made to safeguard these critical assets within our society, whether it's chemical plants or mass transit or a public health system and so forth. And in the trade-off issues here, you know, what I think the 7/7 attacks, the ones that took place in London against the underground system here we saw, is that it was the resiliency of that system and of the British people that I think have, you know, made a difference in how that society was able to respond and mitigating the consequence of that attack.
Okay. Stephen Flynn, again, at the Council on Foreign Relations. Come back to you. I've made a lot of points. I want to go back to Richard Falkenrath at Brookings, formerly with the Bush administration. What about this first point, that the order of priorities is wrong? What we should be doing is assessing the vulnerability, then figuring out what it would cost. Where did the numbers come from, whether it's $765 million for this one program we've talked about or the $2 billion for the whole Department of Homeland Security?
Well, it's not $2 billion for the whole Department of Homeland Security. It's more like $3.5, and then there's another $1 billion over at the Department of Health and Human Services. And those numbers, it's true, were largely arbitrarily determined after 9/11 in the president's first post-9/11 budget, which he sent up in February 2002. The White House staff, on which I served at the time, basically made up the numbers, and it did so mostly by multiplying the existing grant budgets, which were very small, by about a factor of 20. And so there was this huge increase in the money. And there have been criticism on both ends of that, by the way. People like Steve Flynn say it's way too little. There's other people who say the money's being wasted. And you cited some examples of where it's being wasted. And mm-hmm. I, in fact, have seen a lot of waste of that money. And I'm not convinced that it didn't grow too fast in too short a period. So that's how the money was determined. The total amount of money the federal government has handed out to state and local agencies for homeland security since 9/11 is in excess of $20 billion at this point. And I'm not sure it's all been very well spent. Some of it undoubtedly has been well spent and made us safer. Some of it's probably been wasted. So there are critics on both sides of this, and we should be clear about that.
What about the debate that Stephen Flynn says we ought to be having about the role of the federal government as opposed to the states, the local governments, and private industry?
There has been a debate on that. And it's a very complicated issue. Since 9/11, there's been a major expansion of the federal government into civil society, into the prerogatives of state and localities, into the private sector. I mean, just look at what happens at airports these days. It's no longer airport authorities who run airport screening. It's now TSA. And a lot of people don't like that and think it's highly inconvenient. So we could go around the entire country and catalog areas where the federal government has or has not increased its authority to control civil society in one way or another. And it turned out to be extremely controversial in each case. And there are hard arguments to be made on both sides of expansion and conservative restraint.
What about the basic point that Stephen Flynn made that the major resources have gone, as he put it, to offense rather than defense, taking the battle to the enemy at enormous cost, given what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, arithmetically, he's right. I mean, we spend more money on the operations abroad than we do at home. There's no question. At least by a factor of 10, if not more. I think he's wrong, though, to say that that's a bad idea. I do believe that the best defense is a good offense here, and that the best way to defend our country, given how big we are, how porous our borders are, how free and open we are, the best way to defend us is to identify the plots and the threats where they exist and to take them out preemptively through intelligence operations or through military operations to eliminate the sanctuaries and other support structures that they need. And I think the critics of that approach really have a lot of explaining to do when they consider why there haven't been any attacks on the United States in the last 4 years.
Why do you think there haven't been any attacks in the last 4 years? Richard Falkenrath.
Oh, I think Al-Qaeda is on its knees. It's a tiny fraction of what it was before. It no longer has a sanctuary in Afghanistan. I think many elements of the Islamic extremist global network have been penetrated, that we understand them much better. There have been handfuls of plots that have been preempted, both transnational against the United States and in other countries in South Asia and Europe. And there has been a great deal of operational success. The most of the Islamic extremist terrorist activity that we've seen since 9/11 has been localized. It's been ad hoc groups of terrorists who do still hate our way of life and are still motivated to attack us, but are able only to travel across town to carry out their attacks, not across oceans. And that is basically a risk-shifting strategy. It's bad if you live in Europe or the Middle East or South Asia, but for the U.S. homeland, it's probably good.
Stephen Flynn, the suggestion is then that the priorities and policies of the Bush administration are working.
Well, I guess I would disagree on a couple of points. One is I'm calling for more balance. Okay, I'm not saying it's an either or. Forget the offense, come to defense. It's just that our national security establishment, which is very well healed compared to the rest of what the things that the Department of Homeland Security inherited, is essentially on steroids, doing what it was trained to do. And we really, well, we certainly talk about 20-fold increase in budgets. These were very small budgets to start with that haven't given us a great deal of capability. The argument that I'm making overall is there is value to making ourselves a more resilient society from a deterrence level. That one is the offense relies overwhelmingly on good intelligence. And the fact is, as we've acknowledged, the 9/11 Commission and many of the changes, the administration has acknowledged, our intelligence services are deeply broken right now and need a lot of work to get to a point where we're going to have the kind of warning that we need to be able to have the kind of alert-based system and so forth in place. So we need to have a fallback position, given that the threat is ongoing.
What do you mean by more resilience?
What I mean by that is that when we look at the things that are most valuable in our society in terms of that, if you hit them, there would be massive loss of life, like chemical plants, for instance, or our transportation system that supports our manufacturing and retailing sectors. We need to basically look at a three-tiered approach. In some cases, you harden things, like a nuclear power plant or the White House. The other things you may do is more redundancy, and you put a little more extra capacity, so if they hit it, it doesn't have much disruption. The third is you respond well. If something goes wrong, you can fix it in a hurry. Now, these folks don't have unlimited resources, and this gets to the issue of why hasn't it happened in 4 years. In part, the good news is the footprint for Al-Qaeda here in the United States is pretty small. To carry out a sophisticated 9/11-style attack, takes a good bit of organization and time, and up to years, to be able to pull out on a 9/11 scale. If you use that capability, you lose it. That is, you leave the forensic trail, you're going to have to start all over again. So you have to husband the resource, and you have to focus on things that will have the biggest consequence. So I think what we're likely to see looking forward is more attacks in the European context, where the footprint is bigger, and conventional. Here we'll have far fewer, bigger spaces in between, but more likely to be catastrophic. So we have to accept that this is the reality of the world we're in and look at these things that are really valuable to us as society and say, are they really as durable as we need them to be for our quality of life? And then coming back to the dual-use argument, most of the things, like dealing with the bio threat, are things we need to deal with, actually the more scary thing that's out there right now, which is avian flu. That the same system we'll put in place, public health, to deal with that will get us a big leg up on the bioterrorist threat. The things that we put in place to deal with catastrophic storms, as we saw at Katrina, are things that will help us in the aftermath of a dirty bomb attack.
So you buy the dual-use principle then?
I do. I think that's the notion of separating the two operationally doesn't make much sense in terms of how the agencies who do these on the ground. I mean, part of the rationale, I go back to the U.S. Commission on National Security, which I worked on, and the very issue of bringing some of these agencies together, like the Coast Guard and Customs, under one roof that now has evolved into the Department of Homeland Security. The argument was not that these were security agencies. The argument was that they had done non-security things that would give real capability to managing this threat, both in terms of it's the cop on the beat that's going to bump into the terrorist, not the spook running around the mountains necessarily. So they need the capabilities to be tied into the system, resource adequately, not to stop doing their traditional job. But it's the process of doing a Coast Guard officer's where I came from. When you're out there doing a patrol, you can spot people who are fishing where there's no fish because you do fishery patrols.
Okay. Stephen Flynn, again, with the Council on Foreign Relations. Back to Richard Falkenrath, formerly with the Bush administration, now at the Brookings Institution. Three priorities: hardened, obvious targets, have redundancy, and have people respond well. I suppose the most obvious question would be on the latter, and related to Katrina, which you said yourself was a disaster in more ways than one. How are we doing on hardening and on having redundancy?
I'm not sure I accept redundancy as an objective. In terms of hardening of targets, the progress has been very selective. Official buildings of the United States government are better secured today than they were prior to 9/11. The air travel network is better secured today than they were on 9/11. The chemical industry is not. And Steve and I actually are in violent agreement on this one, that's a failure on the part of the administration.
What about the ports?
The ports, it's varied. And in general, I would say not much difference has been made on inherent port security. There's somewhat better inspection of cargoes, but ports are very large, very open systems, and there hasn't been any kind of sweeping airport-like federal intervention to enhance port security.
What would it cost?
Who knows? A lot of money, more than I think the federal government wants to spend at this time, and in a way that might not work. If you visited ports, and Steve really knows ports, anyone who's seen them, they're huge. They're vast and sprawling entities, and to try to defend every port against a, for instance, coal-style attack, which is a small, fast boat loaded up with lots of explosives in a very wide area where anyone can get on and off the water quickly, is a virtually impossible task. So the Coast Guard is doing its best in that area. In individual places, it's probably made a little bit of progress, slightly better awareness, but no radical step function increase of the sort we've seen at our U.S. airports, for example.
Stephen Flynn, let me go back to you on the issue of ports. You do come from the Coast Guard and the argument that you can't protect everything.
Well, and actually, most of the focus of my effort is not a fail-safe system to protect them in the ways we've tried with the airports, hardening everything. But it's basically to make the management of the things that come in our airports with enough visibility and accountability that when something goes wrong, we can manage it well. We know basically where the incident is and where the response needs to happen. So in the case of containers, for instance, which I very much worry about, the big boxes that carry a bulk of the things we need in our manufacturing and retailing sector, the goal is not make every single container a Fort Knox, but if should something go wrong, can you identify where it came from, where the intrusion likely took place, and therefore where do we need to focus our response?
So we're not able to do that at this point.
No, we're still we're not able to. And so the result is we're likely to shut the whole system down as we sort things out in the aftermath.
All right. It
comes back to that need to be more resilient.
We are out of time. I want to thank you both, Stephen Flynn at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of America the Vulnerable, and Richard Falkenrath at Brookings, formerly with the Bush administration. Also, Walter Pincus, national security reporter for The Washington Post. We'll come back and talk more about these issues in days to come, and hope both of you will, or all three of you, will join us again. In Florida today, the former Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff pleaded guilty to conspiracy and fraud in connection with his purchase of a casino boat line. But it's yesterday's pleas in Washington that will resound on Capitol Hill for a long time to come. In a moment, we'll look at what could be a scandal of historic proportions on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Olney back with Popoter's Notebook on To the Point. Jack Abramoff has been talking to prosecutors for some 18 months, and the Department of Justice now says he went far beyond lawful lobbying, which of course includes fundraising for the campaigns of elected officials. Ron Brownstein is national political reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us now. Ron, good to have you back.
Hey, Warren. How are you?
Good.
Happy to be here, first of all.
Same to you. Big question. What is the difference between, according to the Justice Department, what Jack Abramoff has been doing and lawful lobbying?
Well, you know, that is going to – defining that line is going to be one of the most interesting questions as this investigation goes forward. Certainly, the scale of what Jack Abramoff provided, allegedly provided to some of these legislators was enormous. Comped dinners at his restaurants, trips abroad, in perhaps the most egregious case, allegations that he may have funneled contracts to the wives, the spouses of aides or members. But much of it is more difference of degree than of kind with what is done every day. And so I think there are a lot of people nervous in Washington about where exactly the Justice Department is going to draw that line.
The current Attorney General in charge of the criminal division has indicated that there were, and Abramoff apparently in court yesterday when the judge mentioned this and nodded affirmatively or perhaps even said yes, there were official acts committed in exchange for the kinds of things that you describe. How important is that, the so-called quid pro quo?
Well, that is, I mean, that always is the key. When we sort of think about the way, even if you assume that this is essentially, as some people argue, the way Washington works, money flows toward people who agree with you. And certainly Jack Abramoff, more than these personal favors like tickets to basketball games or even the trips to Scotland, what he had to offer was enormous sums of campaign contributions from his clients, particularly these Indian tribes with gambling interests. The defense always is from the elected official that I held this position and someone gave me money because they supported my position, not the other way around. And it is, as we were talking about on the first question, it is very difficult to untangle exactly that chain of causality. And I think that there will be a lot of anxiety here in Washington, both about what the Justice Department is going to do and if further indictments come, how juries will assess whether what seems business as usual to many here is in fact seen as a criminal quid pro quo to others.
Talking with Ron Brownstein of the Los Angeles Times, what specifics do we know at this point that at least give a suggestion as to where the investigation is going and just how extensive it might be on Capitol Hill?
Well, as you know, there's the only specific elected official mentioned in the plea bargain is Representative Number One, so named in it, who is by common agreement Bob Ney of Ohio, the chairman of the House Administration Committee. Beyond that, we don't know, except that there is language in the agreement that talks about giving, offering, and promising things of values to public officials, plural, and their relatives. And the FBI and Justice Department officials who spoke yesterday at the briefing made clear that this was a broad investigation that would move in many directions. Now, there have been different leaked estimates of how many elected officials might be a target, ranging from 3 to 20. I've seen reports that Abramoff has said that he has incriminating evidence on 60 members of Congress. Hard to see it going quite that far, but most people are expecting other shoes to drop.
other shoes. What about the arrangement that what about the relationship of the current majority in Congress, particularly in the form of the former majority leader Tom DeLay, with lobbyists in Washington? What has happened there to associate lobbyists with the Republican Party, particularly, that makes this somewhat different from what's happened in the past?
Well, I mean, what the Republicans have been able to do since they won the majority in 1994 is build a machine that marries both ideology and interest. You know, if you think about the Democratic majority in the 1980s, when Tony Coelho was the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, former congressman from the Central Valley, Democratic congressman, they were
Central
able
Central Valley
to,
of California.
Central Valley of California. They were able to leverage a lot of contributions out of businesses who did not basically support the Democratic view of government, out of the argument that Democrats held the majority and they needed to have friends with their hands on the gavel. Now, since 94, Republicans have had their hands on the gavels in the House the whole way and most of the time in the Senate. And what they've been able to do is build a very integrated and systematic machine that encourages lobbyists to work very that gives lobbyists enormous access in the shaping of many much legislation, but also demands from them support in both contributing to Republican candidates and hiring other Republican lobbyists. I mean, Tom DeLay and the so-called K Street Project, also championed by outside Republican activists like Grover Norquist, have understood that to the extent they can tilt these lobbying firms and trade associations towards Republicans in their staffing, they would be more likely to tilt the ultimate contributions in their direction as well. And they have had this this very, very seamless kind of operation. And now you are seeing, as in so many things in politics, when you know there is no absolute victory, and the seeds of you almost always sow the seeds of the backlash when you have an unfettered hand. And we are seeing in the Abramoff scandal, the potential cost of an approach that is so, in other ways, maximized the potential advantage to Republicans of support from the lobbying community.
Do we think at the moment that the Justice Department is pointing its investigation at what you referred to as the shaping of legislation? Could there be laws that might be in jeopardy as a result of all of this?
I don't know how that would work in terms of whether you know the law itself could be implicated. My feeling about
I don't mean that it would be implicated, but rather that they'd have to take another look at it based on the publicity.
Yeah, conceivably. But you know, my sense has always been that lobbying, the influence of lobbying rises as the general interest in a subject diminishes. Lobbyists tend to have their most power in either inserting or removing aspects of bills that are very narrow in their scope and directly affect, you know, one specific interest rather than sort of the broad public policies. For example, most of the legislative questions are surrounding Abramoff have to do with very particular earmarks for the tribes that he represented. A lot of it is focused on the Interior Department, where he lobbied extensively, and is a whole other front, the administrative front in this. Don't forget that there was the senior procurement official in the Bush administration. Federal procurement official has already been indicted for his dealings with Abramoff. So it tends to be on more narrow, specific things, but we shouldn't overlook the potential of this to spread into the executive branch. In fact, President Bush, as you may know, today his campaign gave back the money that they had received from Abramoff, joining a veritable flood of political figures doing that in the last 24 hours.
Gave back some of the money, $6,000,
yeah,
but in
directly.
Fact, Abramoff was one of those contributors who got special attention from the Bush campaign for getting other people to raise in the neighborhood of $100,000. I take it they're not giving that back.
No, they're not. And in fact, you know, one of the things that's happening very quickly is that Republicans are trying to make the argument that it is hypocritical for Democrats to be raising questions about this because they benefited from Abramoff as well. And to an extent, that is true. Abramoff's clients, these Indian tribes, if you look back since the 2000 election, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Indian tribes gave about $1.5 million to Democrats. They gave about $2.6 million to Republicans, and all of Abramoff's personal contributions, over $200,000 in this period, have been to Republicans. He is essentially a Republican operative who has relied mostly on Republicans to do his legislative business. And although I think Republicans are correct to point out that many many Democrats were sort of supping at this trough, broadly described as well. I think most people think the greatest risk of further legal exposure here is to Republicans because, A, he felt closer to them and worked through them naturally, and, B, they were in the majority, and it made sense for him to work through them in pursuing these goals.
What about Harry Reid, the leader of the minority in the Senate, Democrat from Nevada, who was apparently questioned on Fox News about contributions that he allegedly received, or perhaps not allegedly, but that he in fact did receive. He got very testy about them.
Yes, he did, and I think, you know, you're going to see this is going to be the principal Republican effort, just as Democrats were very happy almost 20 years ago when John McCain was the one Republican caught up in the Keating 5 scandal. Republicans are going to do anything they can to keep Democrats implicated in this. The National Republican Senatorial Committee has said to me today that they are thoroughly prepared to run ads in any state where it's necessary. Montana might be the most likely one to emphasize the ties of Democrats to Abramoff. But again, the challenge for Republicans is that if there are further revelations and further indictments, the risk may be greater to those on the Republican side of the aisle because that was where Abramoff did the majority of his business, and that could change the lens. Right now, about 80% of the public in the most recent poll says they see both parties as equally culpable in corruption in Washington. Democrats really hope to change that. I mean, they're betting a lot on a broad corruption argument in 2006. They don't really have the public with them yet, but they're hoping that further revelations might give them more ammunition.
We will hear more about this in days to come. Ron Brownstein, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
National political reporter, columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Today's program produced by Sharon Rimbaum with Francis Anderton and Katie Cooper, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.